name's Tony Gosling from Bilderberg.org, and it is my honor, pleasure, and various other nice adjectives to welcome him to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Tony, welcome.
Hi, thanks, Vinnie. Thanks for having me on.
Give us a bit of a breakdown about just, you know, yourself, a bit of a background, plug your website and do all that kind of radio self-prostitution that we all love.
Well, I mean, I was a BBC researcher and a reporter for several years in the early 90s, and I had the great pleasure of working on the London Drive Time show for the BBC in the quiz. The radio station for the whole of London. You know, this covers, well, up to sort of 10 million potential listeners, and it was what people used to listen to on their way home in the evenings. And I used to set up a lot of the, well, most of the interviews for that program back in the early 90s, and so I was covering some fascinating, for me anyway, international stories. I mean, the other thing is we had an IRA bombing campaign going on in London at the time, and so I was sort of, you know, one of the first journalists in the country to have a bite of the cherry every time one of these big events happened. And we always felt in radio that we were really way ahead of the TV and the newspapers, obviously, that didn't come out until the next day, at really covering news stories. So, I mean, it's a kind of, it was a bit of a drug, and we used to listen to all the competing radio stations just to make sure that we did better. We had a news team of about something like 15 reporters, a very young news editor, a guy by the name of James Cameron, who was quite a go-getter, and we felt that we were pretty much the great best team, news team in the city. And so I did that for a while in the early 1990s, and got really bitten by the radio news bug. And then I got into environmental campaigning after that, in the late 90s, as part of a group called The Land Is Ours, which really made the connection with the past, the history in England and Britain of the theft of the land by the rich landowners, and by the people who basically, you had to be a landowner to vote, and so they basically voted themselves the land, and this was what we call the enclosures. The privatisation of land in England, and, well, right across Britain. And that was, I suppose, the beginning of people's total bondage into the money system. So, you know, once you've had the land that you need for your livelihood taken away from you by these landowners, and, you know, you're evicted, the land is privatized, someone takes it over, then you really do have to earn money to live. And this was the fuel, really, for the Industrial Revolution, and it's why it happened in England, because, you know, it was the English Civil War, where the merchant classes took over from the old feudal classes during the Civil War. King Charles I had his head chopped off, and Oliver Cromwell and his cronies took over the merchant class, the City of London, really, and the people that were, are now responsible for the financial crisis, along with, you know, Wall Street and other European financial centres. So that's what we were doing. We were campaigning around land rights and the fact that we've got, just in Britain, we've got about 60 million acres of land, and we've got 60 million people in the country, roughly. So we've got an acre each. That's about a football field each. And what's happened is, you know, the vast majority of those people don't actually own any land. Even if they've got a mortgage on a house, they don't actually own that. So we're all having to work very hard just for a basic human right, which is the right to have somewhere to stay, somewhere to live. And people right across this country, as I speak, and in other parts of the Western world, are simply being evicted for the crimes of a few bankers who have been rewarded for their crimes rather than jailed for them. So you can see where I'm coming from, pretty much social justice point of view, journalism, and in and out of journalism and in and out of environmental campaigning.
Well, have you noticed that when you become a journalist, you kind of get confronted with that choice about how biased does your journalism get, and how much of an emotional investment do you actually want to put forth in those issues that you're covering?
Well, the clear choice for me was at what point am I going to just, shut up about what I really believe in as part of my journalism and bite my tongue and think about my career. And I made a decision very early on that the profession, I wasn't, you know, it wasn't worth carrying on the profession if I wasn't just going to say exactly what I thought about everything and not to compromise that. And this is, it was pretty much at this point, once I'd come out of working for the BBC, that I came across the Bilderbergers, And I was really staggered to see lists of these people attending these secret meetings every year who really control most of the money in the Western world. I mean, you know, almost all the money in the Western world, certainly all of the central banks, the European Central Bank as well, the Federal Reserve, the World Bank, the IMF, all these big financial institutions which have been set up after the Second World War. And the kind of the gnomes of Zurich, the Basel bunch, all these people seemed, you know, they were in this, having these secret meetings along with royalty, the royalty of Europe, and along with big chief executives like Rupert Murdoch's chief executive, big media corporations, governors of the BBC, all meeting up in secret to discuss confidentially financial policy. And I was staggered to see that this was going on, really, and not being reported anywhere in the press. And I'm glad to say that partly due to my efforts and those of many others over the last 10-15 years, that now is actually a bit of reporting of this in the press, even if it is just bits and pieces on the Guardian website, and also some very, very good journalists and people like Charlie Skelton have really picked up the baton and are dishing the dirt on these people because they are criminals, the highest level, and that's why they want to keep these meetings secret, not because they're private in any way. Oh, and incidentally, we discovered this year that the Bilderbergers, George Osborne, the British Chancellor, was at the Bilderberg Conference with his Treasury team. So that blows out of the water any possibility that these meetings, as the Bilderbergers themselves say on their website, are that they're private meetings. Of course, they're not private meetings. They are formal government meetings. And it really shows us that democracy is a farce because the Bilderbergers have been selecting our up-and-coming leaders of opposition parties and, it seems, prime ministers for decades now. So it doesn't matter, you know, really which way we vote. There is a financial elite that is choosing the main rulers in the Western world. And, of course, yeah. It is a NATO operation. This is a kind of political arm of NATO where you do wonder who's really in charge. You know, is it the military or is it the politicians?
Well, I was on Facebook this morning and I saw a picture with a guy holding a sign that says if voting could really change anything, it would be made illegal. And that prompted me to update my status to saying anything that makes a positive difference will soon be made illegal.
Well, that's actually the title of a book. I mean, it's an old slogan, but it's a title of a book by the ex-Labour MP, the ex-Mayor of London, Ken Livingstone. He wrote a book called If Voting Changed Anything, They'd Abolish It. And that was after his experience of being abolished himself as the leader of the Greater London Council, because it was a left-wing council. It was abolished in the 1980s by Margaret Thatcher, and he wrote that book as a kind of historical record of what happened when London voted for a left-wing leader. Mrs. Thatcher, as a right-wing conservative prime minister, decided to abolish the entire council because the Londoners had voted for the lefties. But, I mean, this whole idea of not voting, I mean, I would say it's still very important to vote because, you know, you can actually vote in decent local members of parliament we have here and other representatives in other parts of the world, and also on local authorities, on small local councils, you often find you have real politicians of integrity that you can vote for. So I wouldn't write it off. I think the idea is to disillusion us by commanding the top structures of our political parties, the very top. And also, I mean, you look at figures like Robin Cook, the British... I mean, we had the big scandal at the end of last week with the resignation of the Conservative Defence Secretary, Liam Fox, for having an Israeli agent operating from his office... in his office. Bizarrely, the head of the armed services, that is the top soldier, he was a RAF pilot, Jock Stirrup, as soon as Ian Fox was appointed last year, he brought this up. He was saying, what is this guy Adam Werity doing in the office? And Jock Stirrup was then retired early. But it's now come out quite clearly that this guy was operating in there. But, OK, so Liam Fox has resigned, but let's not forget the Labour Party, the previous government, their Foreign Secretary resigned also, but he resigned on great principle, and that was a guy called Robin Cook. Robin was a brilliant arguer. He was a fantastic politician, very, very articulate, and not long after that, he had a very strange accident on a mountain in Scotland, and I would suggest it's quite possible that he was at that point bumped off in a similar way to David Kelly, the weapons inspector, was bumped off. And so I think this proves that actually politics is very important still, since it seems that there are politicians out there who the forces of darkness, if we can call them that, like John F. Kennedy, for example, that they want to remove them.
You remember that speech Kennedy made about this monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that buries all its mistakes and never publishes them and that kind of thing? And a guy try and convince me that he was talking about the Russians.
Well, I think the thing is, at the time, there was the Americans believed that communism was a ruthless conspiracy against the Christian world. I don't know if you remember, but I mean, the speeches that Winston Churchill gave at the beginning of the Second World War were that Hitler wants to end Christian civilization. Well, there isn't any kind of talk like that anymore, because it seems that our leaders don't really follow Christian principles anymore. So that was the problem, I think, with Kennedy at the time, is he was flagging up the idea that Christian civilization was going to be ended by a conspiracy run from communist countries, who, of course, at the time, the Russians and the Chinese, were vehemently anti-Christian and, you know, were campaigning against any kind of religion as part of their creed, which is a great pity, you know. And I think that's one of the reasons we're seeing now a great resurgence of Christianity in China, well, in even a larger extent in Russia, as people start waking up and realizing that actually this is quite an important part of life, and that there are many people that want to live that way, as of course they should be able to. But actually, the unfortunate thing with Kennedy was that the bigger conspiracy was a conspiracy in his own country, which was particularly against Catholics and particularly against his family or anybody of integrity that stood for office. And I think we have a similar situation here in Britain, that when people of integrity stand for office, that their lives are in danger.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I find that it therefore is the responsibility of the voting public to indeed try and protect those people, and also the responsibility of the media, more likely the alternative media, to give those politicians who would be in danger as much airtime and coverage as humanly possible to raise their profile. So that way, if anything does happen to them, it'll underline everything that they're saying.
Well, that'd be good if the mainstream press did that. I think we've lost the moral sense a lot in the mainstream press.
Yeah, well, and of course, the mainstream press are owned by the people who would do the killing.
Well, possibly, or I would say certainly people are lied to those who might wish to take out leaders. It does seem certainly that our press has become much more concentrated. I mean, I'm a union activist in the journalist union here in Britain, and that's one of the things that we're constantly banging on about, is we're shocked to see the way that the press, in all its forms, is being consolidated. I mean, the Murdoch empire really is the most obvious case in point here in Britain, where, I mean, they've taken over the massive publishers like HarperCollins. They're publishing loads of magazines, they're publishing newspapers, they're at the top end, in inverted commas, the Times. We've got the bottom end newspapers like the Sun and the old News of the World, which is now, thank God, defunct. And of course, they're also into radio news. They do a radio news service every hour here in Britain, and also Sky News and Fox News in the States. I mean, they're massive. So it'll be very interesting. A lot of people are going to be having an eye on the AGM of News Corp in the United States on Friday to see if James Murdoch, Rupert Murdoch, and the other sort of clones of this private intelligence service, it seems, well, that's what the Murdoch empire has become, are still going to be in their jobs after Friday.
Well, let's hope not. The real difficulty I find with the whole mainstream media apparatus is that not only do they have an inordinate amount of influence about what people think, what people feel, what information people ingest, but they also are capable of buying out and shutting down their competition because they've gotten so large and so heinously monstrous.
I do think maybe the Russians were right in their criticism of the West being a sort of decadent capitalism, because what's happened is slowly but surely these massive corporations have become much bigger than individual countries and individual governments, and they've used that financial muscle. You know, tax write-offs, we're talking about, you know, boards saying, well, we've got to spend X amount of millions of pounds on, you know, almost on nothing, just on lobbying, just so we don't have to pay tax on it. So they then use that money to lobby for changes in the law, to set up black budgets, to bribe politicians, and also to really push for to get their way, and to, as you said, muscle people out of the market. So we you know, you can almost imagine one giant media corporation across the whole of the West in the years to come. Although maybe they would do several, which are kind of secretly working together in order to try and fool the public into thinking that there was some kind of media plurality, which there clearly isn't. I mean, at the moment, the BBC does a reasonable job. I mean, there are programs on there which are problematic. Their general news service is pretty appalling and quite biased in a lot of ways towards the sort of pro-corporate world and the pro-Western, certainly pro-NATO world, where NATO really seems to me like the big bugbear of the world, breaking almost every one of the universal, you know, the declarations in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So, you know, we're in a bit of a grim situation once you've got a media which is just parroting a kind of military-industrial complex, and that's the way things are going. But, I mean, it's almost bound to happen in a way, because we've got politicians weakened by the power of these massive corporations. And the wealth is being sucked out of private hands into corporate hands. Slowly but surely, this is something which hardly gets noticed. But the corporations are sucking their way, all this private wealth, into these faceless corporate bodies.
Yeah, well, basically, I look at it like this. It's like a giant spider, and you're caught in its web, and it's injecting you with something that liquefies your insides that they can suck out through a singular fang. We'll be right back. Tony, welcome back.
Hi. Also, just remind you that we do ourselves in Bristol a two-hour current affairs radio show every week. We've been doing it for about the last 2 years or so. And that is, if it's Greenwich Mean Time or British Standard Time, that's 5 till 7. It's a drive time program for people to listen to on their way home on a Friday night. And that is, the website for that is thisweek.org.uk. That's thisweek.org.uk, so I'll give that a little plug, and also let you know as well, we've got a big, something that's been big in the news this week is the Hillsborough disaster, which was when 90-odd people died when the police allowed, this is nearly 20 years ago, the police allowed a load of massive crowds to go into a stadium at the beginning of a football match, and there was a terrible crush. All the people died. We've actually got an exclusive this week from an inside source at the police about the main reason behind that, because the government have been talking about releasing this information, and again on Monday they fudged it. They put it off yet again, and I think many of the families and the victims of that disaster have been calling for the release of these files. So we're going to do a little exclusive this week. What we try and do is focus on Bristol, which is a real thriving city. I mean, we are the city that discovered America, apparently. We're told John Cabot or Giovanni Caboto sailed off in the late 1400s and discovered America from this very city. This is where he managed, where the sponsors actually sponsored him on his boat to find America, allegedly. I mean, I'm not absolutely sure about the truth of that, but certainly that's the way the stories are told on the ship called the Matthew. And we've got a replica. Matthew sits in the harbour here still. So we are a regional city, and what we do is we do a kind of national and international news programme from a regional city's point of view. So we also look at some of the big stories that are happening in our city as well at the moment. Even our football team, Bristol City, or one of them, which is doing incredibly badly at the moment, and I think that's karma, because they're trying to also build a massive stadium on a beautiful green field site on the edge of the city, and ever since they've been doing that, the football club seems to be just going down and down through the various leagues and failing miserably.
Yep, so sounds about right. And speaking of going down and down and failing miserably, Rick Perry, a Bilderberg attendee, is now getting his ass whomped in the polls. And there was a. Do you know what POTUS is? POTUS.
No.
No? Well, just wondering, like, what would the Bilderberg choice candidate be, seeing as their original golden boy, freaking Rick Perry, Rick Pedophile Perry, seems to be going down in the polls?
Well, it doesn't surprise me that a lot of these Bilderbergers aren't doing too well as the whole thing slowly unfolds. I mean, let's not forget about Conrad Black. Back in the 90s, he was hosting Bilderberg conferences at his swanky pad over in Canada and actually hosting the Bilderberg conference. And at that point, he was taking over. In fact, at the time, he was chairman of Hollinger, who were owners of the Daily Telegraph, Jerusalem Post, and various other big newspapers. And he's suddenly jailed and he's behind bars. So how are the mighty fallen? It's nice to see there's still a little bit of justice around for these people, but they do seem to be very clever at evading capture, particularly the financial ones who seem to have the biggest pockets to bribe their way out of any like kind of justice.
Like this dominatrix Strauss-Kahn character.
Well, I mean, I'm a big fan of DSK, even though he was the chairman of the IMF and he was a regular attendee at the Bilderberg conferences. It seems quite clearly he had a mind of his own to a certain extent. And I think we have to be very careful about characterising Bilderberg as a bunch of people who are all of one mind, because that certainly is true. I mean, you look at the people who are actually in charge of it, it's not the DSKs of this world, it's the Henry Kissingers, the David Rockefellers, the Kenneth Clarks, he's now our Justice Secretary under the Conservative government. These are the people on the steering committee that decide on the agendas of the Bilderberg conferences and decide who's going to be invited. And, for example, back in the 90s, Will Hutton was an example of someone who's invited along to a Bilderberg conference. At the time, he was the editor of the Observer newspaper, which is a Sunday edition of The Guardian. And Will was quite clearly not that impressed with what he saw at the Bilderberg meeting. In fact, he wrote about it, even though they asked him not to, in his column in the newspaper a little while after. And it's quite clear from the comments he makes on TV and as part of his job at the Work Foundation that he's a very different view of economics to the Bilderberg. So the whole Bilderberg conference thing is not totally a setup. It's a kind of schmooze fest where people get invited who are in positions of power in order to attempt to get them on the program of the global financial elite. You know, we're talking about the World Bank, IMF.
So is this more or less a very high-level recruitment meeting?
Absolutely right, exactly. And it's also a chance for the super elite to really to meet some of these up-and-coming political stars and to make their decisions about whether they think they want to back them or not. I mean, my colleague described it as a kind of horse fair. And also, of course, you're schmoozing them with all the royalty, you know, the idea being that when people come along, they're just overawed by the fact that they've got all these rich and powerful people in the same place who are all singing from the same hymn sheet, and they have to question, you know, who am I to doubt them. It's a massive public relations exercise by the global financial elite. I think that's clear. That's what the Bilderberg's about.
And on top of that, they have closed-door meetings with this, with several members, the people who are already brought into the fold, who have been many, many times attended members, and they also have these larger conferences where they have everybody involved, that kind of thing. So you can be assured, of course, that the very underhanded and dodgy stuff will be done in the smaller, behind-closed-door meetings with the elite of the elite, wouldn't you think?
That's right. Well, and I mean, those people are flagged up in the steering group. But it's also important not to forget, I mean, the reason that I drew my attention attention to this organisation was the fact that the founding chairman and the person that convened the very first Bilderberg meeting at his own private hotel in Holland was Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who had been an enthusiastic member of Hitler's SS. You know, so the idea that this is a conference, a secret Western conference, convened by a former SS officer, it really shocked me. And I don't think at that point I could really say this isn't important enough to cover and to get the information. In fact, when I very first put some of the lists of attendance, this is back in 1996, up on the internet, the website was so hit by so many hits that it actually closed itself down. And I got a little message from my service provider saying, oh, you know, you've had your bandwidth, mate, you know, sorry. But there's a vast interest in this, and I'm glad to say now that when it comes to the Bilderberg conference season, and you know, people, this is flagged up to people, that they have a good chance to research all, pretty much all of the background, which I must say, you know, it's not only the SS, Hitler's Nazis that were involved in starting it up, it's also Freemasonry is quite clearly involved with this. The Andrew Palmer is the guy that convened the last Bilderberg meeting to take place here in the UK at Turnberry in Scotland in 1998. Andrew Palmer is the personal assistant of the Duke of Kent, who's the head of World Freemasonry. So the idea that this is just some sort of coincidence, and because he was such a good personal assistant to the Duke of Kent, somebody else completely different outside Freemasonry decided he was the right guy for this secret job, I think that's laughable, because it makes a clear connection between Freemasonry. And also Joseph Rettinger, who helped set up the first Bilderberg meeting in the 50s with Prince Bernhard. He was also a Mason, and there's quite a lot being written in Polish now over in Poland about Rettinger's background, who it seems was working for MI6 during the Second World War. So, you know, this is the origin of the organisation, very much secret, but hopefully now, through me and others, a lot of more people now around the world know about it and are writing about it. Pepe Escobar's another one who's been writing about it a lot in his columns in the Asia Times. But people are starting to understand that actually this is the way the Western world works, and it disgusts me when I see people talking about us spreading democracy to other parts of the world, when we quite clearly, with organisations like this in control, we have a totally dysfunctional democracy ourselves. You know, we've got to get our own house in order before we start bombing our way around the world, spreading democracy.
Yep. Well, it seems that democracy itself is, like Thomas Jefferson said, it just gives the 51% the ability to take the rights away from the remaining 49%.
Well, it depends. No, not necessarily. I think when it works well, when you've got very strong, forceful media, as we did have in this country, actually, in the 1960s and 70s. We had a very good independent media that was doing some really good investigative documentaries. We had scandals blown apart within days of things happening back then. But now we have a paralyzed mainstream media that's not able to do the sorts of investigations it was able to do in the time. I mean, democracy is actually a principle, which is the people rule. And the idea is that without interference, it works quite nicely, that people choose their own representatives to make the laws that they want. But what's happened is that there's been covert interference over many years. I mean, certainly over the last 20, 30 years here in Britain since the Thatcher government. I mean, I would suggest probably the last really decent prime minister we had in Britain here was Harold Wilson in the 70s, who was a fairly down-to-earth guy, puffing away on his pipe and looking out for the average Joe here in Britain. But once it's undermined by the powerful interests, mostly from the City of London, and through instruments like the Bilderberg conferences being totally corrupt, that does destroy democracy, and it means that the politicians are hamstrung when it comes to actually dealing with the city, which is what they should be doing right now. You know, we really have that politicians are our last line of defence against the city, and so they have to come up with something. And the fact that Dominique Strauss-Kahn was sting operation was run against him a couple of months ago is pretty clear that there are some people out there in the various different financial institutions and in our politics who do have the people's interests at heart, and so they have to still take people out from time to time from the system. But I mean, yeah, we can just, get into the grassroots of all this, really, is to do with, you know, fairness and sharing resources around the world. Another thing which bothers me is the way that people keep coming up with this whole thing of population. You know, the world population is getting too many. And whenever anyone says that to me, my reaction is, well, I don't know about you, but my reaction is always, okay, you can go first then. Because, you know, we don't actually have a population problem. What we have is a resource distribution problem, and we have a problem of fairness. And if we can, if you know, the only way, and this is a message really going out to the Occupy Wall Street people and the Occupy Stock Exchange people here in London, is we need to start again with regard to the land. The land needs to be redistributed, and people need to be able to choose whether they go into a sort of commercial money finance world or whether they are subsistence farming. I mean, it might sound like a real Luddite retrograde, and incidentally, it's the 200th anniversary of the Luddites in November, a step, you know, smashing up machinery and going backwards, but I think we need to do that if we're going to survive on this planet. You've got the ecological crisis as well as the financial crisis, so we need to go back to the basics, which is land. And if we've all got land and we're not paying rent, we're not paying tax to live there, actually we can get along really loads better. And it's by robbing us of the land, as happened over the last several hundred years by the merchant classes, starting here in Britain, I'm sorry to say, and then rolling out in other parts of the world, by robbing us of the land. That's how the rich have stolen the march on the poor, and the poor need to have the land back.
Well, we're talking about a new reality here. It's what I've called the time in history where we're experiencing an everything crisis. You know, we've got a financial crisis, a food crisis, a inflation crisis, an oil crisis, a political crisis, a protest crisis, 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 crisis. And what's the motto of the 33rd degree Freemasonic law? It is order ab chao, order out of chaos. And incidentally, if you ever look at pretty much every photo that Karl Marx is in, he's always got a hand inside his shirt, which is a Freemasonic symbol for the hidden hand pulling the strings. We'll be right back. And we've got Tony Gosling here from Bilderberg.org. And you also had another website where you do a weekly report. What was that site again?
That's thisweek.org.uk. That's where we basically add 2 hour-long MP3s that people can download to their iPlayer or whatever they want to use, and play, burn it onto a CD, listen to it in the car. We speak to quite a few people here in Bristol that do that. You know, download a few MP3s from our archive and have a listen to those, because we've got basically what we do in the first hour every week is we have a politician on, say, you know, either an MP or a councillor or maybe a candidate. Political candidate, and we go through the week's news with them. But in part two, that's where we do the kind of more out there stuff, a bit of investigative reporting and analysis of the global news, which you can't really expect our local councillors here in Bristol to have their head around what's going on in Iran. I've got a colleague who's an old Labour Oxford economist, Martin Summers. He did PPE at Oxford, which is the Prime Minister's degree, and he's really a very good, I think, at analysing the whole and really decoding some of the jargon in economics, making it easy to understand. I mean, he says week after week that, you know, what's happened essentially is we've got a whole load of bankrupt banks that the politicians haven't got the guts to take them on and to enforce the law, saying, well, look, actually, these banks are... we were talking, for example, a couple of weeks ago about zombie banks. You know, this is something which is, I think, a great way of describing the way that these banks are financially ruined, but and yet they're still carrying on as if they can really be, financially successful.
And then they run around looking for somebody new to run them, going, brains, brains. It just doesn't work.
There is. I mean, this is really a characterization of the whole idea of that fantastic film from whatever it was about 8-10 years ago, The Corporation, which goes into detail about how legally these big corporations are actually people and they can do pretty much everything that a person, a human being, can do. The only thing is that the way that this capitalist system is set up is that the most ruthless, most selfish people in that corporation get propelled to the top positions of power. And if one of them shows an ounce of conscience, they get simply ejected from it. So you've got a pretty hideous system. I mean, I think actually that would be one of the first things I'd do if I had any kind of power in the legislature, is stop the ability of companies to actually be treated as if they were people, and stop them being able to do things like, for example, own land, and do some of the basic things that people can do. Make it so that this is okay, you know, you can run a business, but this business should never ever be treated as if it was a person, and be able to have the same sort of rights as a person does. The other thing, of course, is you know, if that corporation commits a crime, if somebody dies because of negligence by that company, then heads must roll. You know, individuals have to take responsibility. I mean, it seems to me almost set up to be a kind of criminal cover, a bit like a Masonic lodge is often a place for, you know, really to foster an idea that you can do criminal activities with impunity because your fellow Freemasons or, you know, people in your cult will cover for you and will never speak ill of you outside that circle. So, you know, in the same way, the company seems set up to be a kind of cover for ruthless activity, and I think it's absolutely appalling the way it does propel people who are the most ruthless in that company up to the positions of power. There's something totally, you know, sort of inhuman about that. The other thing is, you know, just going down today, as I did, to the centre of the city here in Bristol, to see a whole bunch of people camped out on our college green. It's a bit of land right outside the city council house, and by the cathedral too. The land is owned by the cathedral and the cathedral school, and the cathedral authorities have quite graciously said, yes, you can stay here, as far as we're concerned, as long as you want, because there's an understanding, I think, from the cathedral authorities, from the church, that, you know, there is something wrong in society, that the politicians have failed to in their democratic duties, and there's a lot of ideas, there's a whole load of ferment there. One of the things that we was chatting to them about was this whole business of the time-honoured or time-worn competition between our political representatives and private interests to control the money system and to own the system for issuing money. And a great concept, which of course is there back in the Old Testament of the Bible, is this concept of the Jubilee. Now, I don't know if you've come across that, have you?
No.
Right, the Jubilee is the idea of complete forgiveness of debt. It was actually based in Leviticus, I think it's about Leviticus 25, the idea being that people who own land back in those days, they could sell that land, but it would only be for a limited period of time. After 50 years, that land would then return to the original owners. And this was a way of making sure that if a family hit on hard times, that it would only ever be temporary. So the actual quote runs something like, that the land is God's and you are my tenants. So how can you sell the land permanently? You can't sell the land permanently. And this is actually, I think, a pretty clear message from the old scriptures that, you know, we are only here temporarily on the earth. And the idea that we think that we can own a slice of it and sell it permanently and make money from it is just appalling. And, you know, if you look around you, certainly here in Britain at the moment, there are quite big chunks of land owned by corporations and by individuals which are just completely derelict. You know, the idea being that this is just like money in the bank to somebody, that it's an investment, whereas obviously people like you and I need to live somewhere and we need to work somewhere, and yet this land is being kept permanently derelict because someone sees it as just as an alternative to having money in the bank. So the idea of Jubilee really is debt forgiveness and also giving back land that you've had for years. So, I mean, you know, certainly one of the things I think which is people are thinking about in many of these camps around the United States and certainly here in Britain, and just chatting to people today here in Bristol, is the idea of a complete debt moratorium. It is, that is, throw away this debt into the bin. called the bluff of the bankers, because this is part of the capitalist system. You know, if the money can't be paid back, and if it doesn't look like the money's going to be paid back, as Moody's and Standard & Poor's have been saying recently, then you just it's politely stick two fingers up to the bank and you say, sorry, we aren't paying it back, and you have a mass default, at which point you have to start again. And I think that's the sort of thing that people are chatting about around the country here in Britain, and probably in the United States too, saying, well, actually, the system is a mess, so let's wipe the slate clean and start again.
I don't agree that it's capitalism. I think it's more like psychopathetism, or less, is that all the people
have control over the resources and the issuance of capital
and all of that, they've built up all this fake debt so that they can get everybody into this trap, and then they'll use that fake debt that they made up as a lever so that they can consolidate and take all their private property off them and foreclose on them, and that way... Basically, they're turning the entire world into this monolithic type communist gangster government state.
Yeah, I mean, what we've got is we've got a system, though, where capitalism, where money is becoming the master of people rather than the servant of people. And I think that's the problem with capitalism
That's the problem with private banks issuing that currency. If it was our elected officials who were actively regulating the value of the currency, not overinflating it, devaluing people's wages, or doing any of that kind of stuff, we wouldn't really have that problem. I mean, the U.S. economy was expanding very rapidly and very little poverty up until the Federal Reserve system came in. And
I think it was in 2000, we had a campaign here at the G8 conference in Birmingham, which was being held in Britain that year, called Jubilee 2000. And this was, again, a reference back to Leviticus, saying, look, let's just forgive all this third world debt, you know, as it was at the time. It was the IMF was pressurizing many African and South American countries at the time, in fact, it was just after that, wasn't it, that Argentina had a massive crash, another IMF riot, and three presidents within a week, and that is the kind of thing that's now, same kind of pressure that was being applied then to the developing world is now being applied to Europe and to the United States. So, you know, we're getting towards the end, I think, of any kind of credible capitalist creed. I have no problem with people making money and actually producing stuff and innovating at all, but I think the capitalism I dislike is that which puts this above all else, which really throws the morals away and puts the money making right at the top, and I think that's really the big problem.
Yeah, I think you're right, eh? I mean, like, there's no inherent problem with capitalism, there's no inherent problem with the monetary systems so far as it's run by moral and ethical people, but as we have a look round society, morals and ethics have been weeded out and more or less exterminated with mass media and all of these other influences that are on people, encouraging us all to be, you know, sexually promiscuous and not care about anything and value rugby over the government. In fact, a recent poll in New Zealand said that 33% of the country believed that the outcome of the rugby was more important than the outcome of the election.
Well, I mean, in a way, you can understand why, because people actually just want to be entertained and they want to be lighthearted and they want to be in the comfort zone. A lot of our political discourse right now is actually profoundly uncomfortable, and I think this is actually part of the psychological trick, the psychological warfare which is being waged on the world at the moment, is to actually make people completely abhor the entire political system so they don't engage with it.
Yeah, I think you're right, and we'll have to get into more of this after the break. The Vinnie Eastwood Show.com. Now, we were talking about in the Vinnie Eastwood Show chat room here about what's the road to salvation, because everybody wants to talk about the problems, and often we kind of miss out the solutions because the problems are so darned interesting.
Salvation? Well, I mean, there is a pretty clear vision there, biblically, for the way things should be. And, I mean, this is kind of where we left off, really. I was brought up in the 1960s in British primary schools, where every morning we would sing hymns. I mean, at the time I used to sit there thinking, you know, do we really have to sing these silly hymns, and what is this whole God thing, and isn't this a kind of, like, propagandistic idea? But, you know, used to sing along. In fact, it was, you know, quite an innovating thing to be doing. And I think that's something we've missed, we've lost. We've lost the whole reason why our parents agreed hundreds of years ago to give up their children to be educated in a public institution. They only did that because they felt that they were getting a good moral education. And that has gone out the window. In fact, now, you know, a lot of our education is amoral and shall we say, secular. The idea that, you know, you can actually be taught about God in anything other than a religious studies class where you're looking at monks and monasteries and this kind of thing is out the window. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, all of our youngsters should be being brought up with, you know, some pretty clear moral values from their elders, from their parents. And that seems to have been completely expunged from most of our curriculum. So I think, you know, you can look at the lack of moral guidance that a lot of young people have got nowadays and look straight to that, you know, as a reason, you know, the taking away of the Christ's message, which was very much there when I was at school, from our schools, and the sort of whole thing of political correctness, where in order to, if anyone uses that kind of message in school, that they may get complaints made about them. I mean, it's similar in our hospitals now, where if a nurse or a doctor approaches a patient and says, you know, would you like me to pray for you, they can be sacked for it. And in fact, some of them have been sacked for it. And this kind of thing, I think, is a really kind of militant atheist approach, which is under the disguise of this whole thing of political correctness. So, I mean, I think, you know, first of all, look from the ground up at the land and land rights and the money system, and that needs to be sorted out, corrected, made fair for everybody, and then look at the way our children are brought up and think to yourself, do you really want your kids brought up without a moral education? And don't be afraid to actually say, look, I think this is the right way to bring your children up.
Yeah, well, see, I was thinking about this the other day, is that the whole morals and ethics and what have you, basically the only reason why Western society even had any, why you had people who talked about respecting your elders and not swearing at the dinner table and making sure you clean yourself, blah, 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 all of these things. It was basically brought about by just generations of parents reading the Bible to their children. And now it's almost like to be Christian is to be some description of, I don't know, crazy person, a dangerous person. They get demonized all over the media.
The mainstream media, certainly the mainstream media and the general education. But, you know, one of the clearest examples of this is the lack of respect for older people, for our elders. We've now got a thing which is really pushed through magazines, through Rupert Murdoch's magazines, amongst others, and through the TV, is the cult of youth, the cult of good looks, and the cult of, you know, this really is an obsession, you know, where people just see young, good-looking as the only thing, really, worthwhile. This is also, of course, pushed massively through advertising and the whole public relations business, the whole propaganda business, which has developed, you know, by Edward Bernays, picked up by Joseph Goebbels and the Nazis. And now the public relations industry has become massively more powerful than the industry of journalism. And the profession of journalism is constantly fighting against the lies and propaganda spewed out by these public relations companies and by, you know, public relations individuals. I mean, if you look, for example, I mean, I know quite a few people in the Journalist Union who are public relations people, and that even they are tearing their hair out because they're being told to do totally unethical things the whole time. I mean, for example, back in the 1970s, I know a guy who's been working in PR for a long, long time, and he was saying back in the 1970s, it was a real joy to work. For example, he was working for what was called the Gas Board at the time. That was the nationalised gas industry, you know, because after the Second World War, certainly in this country, we realised you've got to have all the basic services nationalised so that they are provided to the public at cost, and not with a load of fat cats taking profit out of them. So the gas, electricity, telecoms, railways, all that kind of stuff was in government hands. And he was saying at the time that if anything ever went wrong with the system and there was a news story to do with the gas, that the chief executive would be the first person to step forward and say, right, I'll go on TV and explain this and to carry the can. Nowadays, it's just a lies management program. So the person responsible, that is to say a chief executive of a big, say, gas corporation, a privatised gas corporation, or even sometimes public corporations such as the... or public organisations such as the police and the health service over here, they have a public relations management system which just simply manages it as if they were a private business. That is to say, the only consideration is the maintenance of the image of the business. So this PR industry is really incredibly powerful nowadays, and one of the best websites in the world for checking out public relations and spin-related stuff is something called spinwatch.org. They are based up at Glasgow University, and one of their writers, Tamasin Cave, has been doing some fantastic work at really picking apart the way that the lobbying industry is trying to get every last national industry, including things like our Royal Mail and the National Health Service, absolutely everything, into private hands through covert lobbying, secret lobbying, like this guy, Adam Werety, who was there in the Ministry of Defence as a private lobbyist, working right alongside the Defence Secretary as a kind of parasitic foreign policy. So this is being untangled by some people. I always give massive respect to people like spinwatch.org that do this work day in, day out. And if there are any journalists listening out there, if you're ever looking for, you see one of these faces pop up on the TV saying they're an independent expert, just punch their name into spinwatch.org and you will see who their backers are, you know, who's been paying the money over the years, which lobbying firms they've worked for, and all this kind of stuff, which is crucial information to know if you're ever going to get to the truth.
Yep. And I feel wholeheartedly that there has to be organisations like this that really do the investigation. And it's more to the point, though, that that's only one part of humanity's defence mechanism against all of this kind of crap going on. I mean, I'm not Christian per se. In fact, if you look at my morals and ethics standards and everything, actually, technically, I'd be closer to being a Muslim than anything else, ironically enough. But I feel personally that you don't actually need to demonize other people's belief structures and things of that nature in order to advance your own agenda. If anything, the only time that people do that is because they've got something nasty planned and they don't want people who would resist it to be around when they implement their plans, right? And that's why I am pretty sure that the New World Order agenda, the Bilderberg Club, and all of these other various scumbags are more or less just an assortment of scheming Luciferian scum.
Well, that's one way of putting it. I mean, the other thing is, I think it's important, whenever you're talking about New World Order, is to actually get your facts straight on what is this New World Order. I mean, certainly I'm not clear about exactly what that term means, and there's lots of different interpretations of it. And also about this whole use of the whole term, the Illuminati. Now, there clearly was a historical Illuminati. Actually, I was at something called the SCADS conference in London on Saturday, the State Crimes Against Democracy conference, which is quite an interesting new concept, which has popped up in London. And Robin Ramsey was speaking there. He's the editor of the Lobster magazine, which is, I would say, is a very well-respected magazine. But I disagree with him profoundly on one thing that he said. He actually denied the existence of any kind of historical Illuminati. And whilst I would say there are deep questions about the actual existence of this organisation today, and certainly under that name. There certainly was an organisation called the Illuminati in the late 18th century, and we really need to go back to the source material from the late 18th century if we really want to understand what this organisation was at the time and what its aims and objectives were, which is clearly spelled out in this book, The Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All the Religions and Governments in Europe, which came out in 1793 and was authored by a guy called John Robison. Now, John was the secretary of the Royal Society of Edinburgh, and he was in a very key position at the beginning of the, well, mid-stages, really, of the Industrial Revolution as what was called a natural philosopher at the time. Basically, they were inventors and people who were discovering, you know, new ways of doing... I mean, he's kind of an engineer, really. And he was a close personal friend of James Watt, who was the inventor of the steam engine. And... really, with their knowledge in Edinburgh, they were fueling the engineering end of the Industrial Revolution. As people were being kicked off the land through enclosure, through privatisation of land, and there were loads of hungry hands waiting to fill the factories, Watt and Robison were two people who were designing the kind of machines that were going into factories to actually produce stuff at an incredible rate like there'd never before been seen on planet Earth. That's what was going on in England at that time. And the interesting thing about Robison was that he was a Freemason, as many of the people were at the time who were involved in that high-end engineering side of the Royal Society. And Robison, also, just as a sideline here, he invented the siren. So, you know, if you can imagine the whole World War II blitz, you know, the siren that was ringing out there was invented originally back in the late 1700s by this guy, John Robison. But Robison saw that there was a big change going on in Europe to Freemasonry at the time, where the various different branches of Freemasonry were being consolidated by this organization called the Illuminati. And he went over to Germany and to France, traveled extensively in Europe, and collected together leaked material, stuff which had been gathered by the police when they'd arrested some of these Illuminati, for example, in Germany, and he translated it all into English, into this really terrific book, which was republished in paperback in the US in the 1970s, called The Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All the Religions and Governments in Europe. So there you have the actual source material on what I think is going on to a large extent in the world today. Not necessarily under the same name, but certainly, you know, if you want to know what the Illuminati are, there is your bedrock of your research, what your bedrock of your research should be. And it spells out the way that this organization planned to take over our heads and our hearts. Our heads through the political parties, through taking over the political parties and things like civil services and that kind of thing in the world of politics, and our hearts through taking over religions, that is to say, infesting Christianity, Islam, and Judaism particularly, with their own people who were the sort of placemen within those organizations. And this is one of the reasons I think we've got this weird thing with Judaism and Islam and Christianity, which is fake versions of them. You've got the Bushes and the Blairs coming out saying that they are Christians, when quite clearly they're not. We've got the Knights Templar right through, you know, far before that in history, who were fake Christians going over doing these crusades to the Holy Land, where actually they were just raping and pillaging and destroying and killing people, you know, rivers of blood in the name of Christ. This is the Knights Templar, and this was also other organizations which similarly mimic that today at the high end of Freemasonry. So, you know, it seems to me pretty clear that, you know, all of these important religions that are around today have, to a large extent, got placemen in there from this Illuminati-style organization. I just recommend your listeners to, if they haven't already, have a look at that particular book. It's a great read, and it's great source material for understanding some of the things I think that are going on today in the world. That's the Robison book, but there's also one called The Code of the Illuminés, which is by Abbé Barouel, and that goes much more into detail also through leaked documents from the late 1700s into the actual rites and rituals of the Illuminati. You know, the actual detail, it's pretty sordid, some of it, but, you know, I think fascinating reading. If people want to understand, you've got to know your enemy.
Yeah, see, and this is what a lot of movements don't kind of comprehend, is that they think that there's no such thing as conspiracy and everything happens by coincidence. You know, sheer effing coincidence. Like Peter Joseph, for example, he criticizes the monetary system and yet denies there's any such thing as a new world order and criticizes anybody as being, quote, effing stupid if they talk about it in any way, shape, or form.
I don't think he should be swearing at people, but I do think it's absolutely fine for people to come at this conspiracy from their own point of view. And I mean, for example, let's take Naomi Klein, for example. I think she's done some absolutely fantastic work, and I would be very surprised if she ever murmured the word Illuminati. Having said that, I mean, she's written a fantastic book about 9/11, which is The Shock Doctrine, and yet she doesn't mention 9/11 once. And I think that's actually admirable that she's done that, you know, and I can understand why people don't want to get drawn into this whole 9/11 conspiracy world. They want to actually appeal to the widest possible audience, and she's done a fantastic and very subtle job in writing the Shock Doctrine to draw attention to the effect of these massive, spectacular attacks that we're seeing on our mass media without even mentioning 9/11. Now, a lot of people would criticize Naomi for not mentioning 9/11 and saying, well, this is, you know, quite clearly one of these attacks that you're talking about. But what she's doing, I think, is much more subtle than that, and it's appealing to absolutely everybody, including those people that still believe the official version of the 9/11 events. They will also be reading and buying her book.
Yeah, I think you're actually right there, and therefore it's actually marketing. It's not so much of an intellectual, I deny that any such thing as a conspiracy exists, I deny that banking families exist, I deny that monetary system was created on Jekyll Island from a bunch of people who had their names kept secret from each other, and they all did it outside of the view of the public and passed the Federal Reserve Act in Christmas time when nobody was around, kind of thing. They don't mention any of that so that they can appeal to the widest audience who think that there is no such thing as conspiracy and it's all coincidence, which I think, as long as you're educating people, ain't really such a bad thing. We'll be right back. Tony, what's your regards to that? Do you think, because I don't prioritise waking up new people, I prioritise keeping those who are already awake sane.
Well, there is that, because you've got a constant blitz from the media, which is trying to make you think that a lot of these issues aren't as serious, you know, and we get constant sort of celebrity stuff coming through. And, you know, the other thing is that generally people don't want to go out of the corner. You know, people don't want to think of a potential World War III around the corner. It's quite difficult to make that comic. But, you know, your whole thing that you've just been talking about there about making light of all this stuff, it is actually pretty heavy. You know, it was pretty heavy in the 1930s in the run-up to the Second World War. And it's difficult to make comedy out of that. But someone that does a fantastic job is Charlie Skelton in The Guardian. And I was absolutely rolling around the latest Bilderberg conference to see his coverage of it, where he was talking about this, as all the people started arriving at the Bilderberg's hotel they were meeting early this year. There was one of the things I can tell you is when you arrive, you're never entirely sure if you've got the right place until the morning that the conference is about to start. And Charlie described how they arrived at the hotel from a neighbouring hotel and discovered that this kind of sheeting had been put up around the hotel to stop anyone taking photographs. But it was a sort of grey sheet, and it looked rather like a shower curtain. And so he entitled his article, "The Shower Curtain of Shame." And you know, this is the way, I think, to poke fun at these people, because they really are taking the mickey. If they think that they can have some sort of little fascist conclab, which it clearly is, in the run-up to a Third World War, and that no one's going to take any notice of them, and that they can cover their crime with a shower curtain run around the outside of the hotel, they've got another thing coming. Yeah, so Charlie's blog that he does on the Guardian website, I think, is really one of the great corners of freedom out there, and it's also a damn fine read, the way he takes the mickey out of these puffed up fascists trying to tell the world how to run things, and that they really do believe that money is their god, and that they are little gods, and I suppose you know, the big bankers are the bigger gods, and they're a whole bunch of fascists, ultimately, trying to make themselves, dress themselves up as somehow credible. So, yes, let's all try and make light of it, because ultimately, I think most of us have read the whole sort of Daniel and Goliath story. We've read The Lord of the Rings. We know that actually it's the honest little guy that triumphs in the end, and that, as we saw at the end of the Second World War, you know, that the fascists do not win, and in fact, in the future, even though they may think they're going to win, we all know that the good guys are going to triumph after all and overall. So I don't know what you think of that, but ultimately I can't see evil triumphing. I think it believes its own propaganda too much. It's totally psychopathic, and therefore it cannot succeed, because ultimately the human spirit will be free. Ultimately people will rise up against this kind of thing, and they will fight it. And it's quite clear that there are parts of empires currently in the world who simply are not putting up with NATO's bully boy tactics. The Chinese threatening the Americans over recent incursions into Pakistan. The Russians clearly kicking NATO's ass in Georgia. And our empire, unfortunately now, seems to have become the evil empire. The transatlantic elite have become the sort of evil empire that have taken on the baton from Hitler's Nazis.
Yeah, yeah, and speaking of the shower curtain, I think they should just, you know, we should get some soap in there and make them slip over or something. But the other part of it is, you're talking about how they believe their own propaganda. Now, here's a question. As Goebbels said, if you repeat a lie often enough, people begin to believe it. But if you repeat a lie to yourself often enough, do you start to believe it, you know? Like, there's this kind of concept that I've come up with where if you become too full of yourself, you wind up getting too far ahead of yourself, overstretching, and the fact that what's that physical paradigm is that for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. So ergo, there must be something really big and good rising in response to this unbelievable, quantitatively empirical empire of scumbaggery.
Well, of course there is. I mean, you know, the human spirit is absolutely uncrushable, and people have been trying to crush it for centuries. Look, the ultimate fact is, though, that it's all very well, this war on terror and all the lies of 9/11. And this is something which people could say, oh, well, we can believe what you're telling us about 9/11, because the consequences of it, these foreign wars, are very long, long way away, and this isn't affecting us. The trouble is, this financial crisis really is affecting people. It's affecting their job security, it's affecting their take-home pay, it's affecting the amount of money they can spend on, say, for example, their children's education or food for the children, and it's all coming home. And it becomes, the comfort zone is actually being encroached upon by the greedy financial elite now. And so I think once people's comfort zone is actually being encroached upon like this, then they stop believing the lies and they start being more sceptical. And I think this is maybe something that the elite have not necessarily factored in. I mean, we've got two big things here which mean that they're going to lose, basically, and we are going to win. And that is, one of them is George Orwell and his book 1984. This is a fantastic book which really does explain, written, yeah. I believe parts of it were written in Bush House at the BBC World Service in London, long after the Second World War. And the book really does explain what's happening, alongside, of course, Huxley's Brave New World. These two books do explain for a mass population, and loads of people, of course, and intellectuals have read these things, the kind of system that these people seem to want to implement. The other thing, of course, is the internet. The internet has allowed us to share fantastic amounts of information, you know, to get news stories from other sides of the world in the English language, and also to read the Pakistani English language press day to day. It's been a fantastic boon to sharing information for those people who are, like myself, who are out there actively seeking it. And these things were not factored in to the evil plans for this kind of future, it seems, fascist kind of state. And I think that's, they're basically, those, to put those two things together, and these guys don't stand a cat in hell's chance.
Yeah, and incidentally, I was actually born in 1984, so it has special significance for me.
Yeah, so, I mean, the thing that is really most bothersome, though, for me about all this financial crisis in the West is that, you know, you just look back to the 1930s and you can see exactly what they're trying to do. You know, the financial crisis is a fascist tactic in order to create the climate for a new Hitler. And it seems to me this is the kind of thing that's being planned by the financial elite, is that if they can wreck the economy in the West, and they are hoping that the people won't notice quite that this is some kind of totalitarian move as it creeps into their lives, as it whacks up their gas and electricity and fuel bills, as it destroys the infrastructure in the countries in the West because things aren't being maintained properly, and ultimately, I think this is waking people up to the fact that, you know, there is a fast one being pulled here. And the trouble is, I mean, this is, again, you see, a lot of violence between races. This is something else that happened in the 1930s. This is something which they're trying to encourage now, racist violence internally here in Britain. You know, a hatred towards immigrants when, actually, to a large extent, a lot of the immigrants here in Britain, apart from ones that have come from Eastern Europe, have come from countries which we've been bombing. You know, we've got a fantastic amount of Somali immigrants in Britain, and Somalia has been targeted massively by our military. And so you can't really blame them for wanting to get away from the horrendous chaos that our military has caused in those countries, particularly the CIA, of course. So these are the sorts of, socio-economic conditions whereby a new Hitler can strut onto the scene and fix the financial system, which, you know, many of us are involved in monetary reform through groups like Positive Money here in Britain and the Bromsgrove Group. There's loads of in different parts of the world have been saying for ages, and fix the money system and appear to be some sort of almost like godlike new leader. Now, this is what bothers me, is that the climate is being created to roll out the red carpet for some hideous kind of fascist leader to come. And I think the fact that it's happened before and the fact that we're beginning to recognise that this seems to be part of the plan means the plan cannot work.
I think that this is what crazy people do, is they come up with a crazy plan and then try and see that crazy plan through to its illogical conclusion, to their own
detriment.
But
nobody dares to tell them that they're crazy. This is the funny thing. No one will dare to go up to Hitler and say, well, I'm very sorry, but, you know, we still haven't taken Stalingrad or whatever. No one dares to go to the super powerful, because they're surrounded by their crony, by sycophants. And there is everyone is always saying, oh, you're wonderful, you're wonderful, and they start to believe it, of course. So I think that in a way that may work in favour of the side of the angels. I would imagine anyway. I mean, it's difficult to know exactly how these things happen, but I mean that's certainly the way I see it.
Well, it's like a liar, for example, tells so many lies, and the only thing you need to do in order to expose them is just listen to them, because they often lie endlessly and then contradict themselves and then instantly expose themselves, basically. And it gets to the point where these people are so crazy that they'll lie to people that they're wearing pants when we can clearly see they're nuts.
Yeah, another big factor in all of this, of course, is the Israeli state. And, you know, we in Britain here bear a big responsibility for creating that entity at the end of the Second World War. A contact of mine who would actually call a friend, a guy called Bill, he was posted over there as part of his national service to Palestine in the 1940s. And, you know, he was explaining exactly how difficult it was dealing with these Jewish terrorists. I mean, they were Israeli terrorists. We don't often hear that term, but, you know, that's the way that the State of Israel was created, through massacres, some of the most horrendous terror attacks. And yet we've got a weird situation with Israel. Really, it's just too bizarre to be contemplated in some way, is that the state is actually a secular state, even though it talks about the Bible. The actual individuals who are running Israel have no real interest in the Bible and certainly don't live by its values. And, you know, in any way, the Old Testament or the New Testament, maybe they are stuck in some kind of Old Testament rut, but they certainly don't seem to adhere to any of the Ten Commandments of God, you know, from the Old Testament. nor from the New, you know, clearly not obviously the New Testament, but we've got these kind of fake versions now of these old-time religions, and it's very, very difficult for people who are honestly of those faiths, ordinary Jewish people who really do follow the Torah, to actually deal with them. I mean, we do have Neturi Carter here in Britain. I'm not sure if they're in other parts of the world, who are, you know, faithful Orthodox Jews who will decry the state of Israel and say this is nothing to do with us, and actually it's certainly not in the Bible. So we've got this kind of fake interpretation of the Bible which runs right the way through, I think, to Revelation, and it also hooks into the whole sort of Templar Masonic mentality where you've got many of these Freemasons actually believe they're guarding the bloodline of Christ for some bizarre reason, and also that the Zionist Israeli state is somehow there to, sort of further God's cause and to get rid of the infidels, where they're actually in a sort of psychotic state. The Israeli state are the infidels, and they are the ones who are doing all the things that God would absolutely abhor. We're in a funny situation with religion, certainly. I don't know what you think, if you would agree with that.
I most definitely do. Have you ever seen the film Young Einstein with Yahoo Sirius?
Never, no.
No? Okay, well, anyway, I made a rip-off of it called Young Finkelstein with Netanyahu Sirius. Tony, like the mafioso. I've got a question in here for the chat room for you, Tony. What's your view on the Council on National Policy? Ever heard of that? I've never heard of that.
No, I haven't, actually. No, I think, certainly one of the things that, looking at the Bilderbergers that comes out from that is quite clear that we've got something called the Royal Institute for International Affairs, Chatham House in London, which is basically a private club which is now virtually running British foreign policy. You have an equivalent in the US, which is the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a formal business lobby of the State Department. And these are like the ivy, which is strangling the tree. You know, they're basically, the tree is now almost completely dead, and the tree is about to fall over because these institutions have been parasiting on our government. And this is what I mean about democracy. Democracy can only succeed as a principle if these kinds of institutions are exposed by the mainstream press and by the government itself. Should really legislate against these kinds of organisations being able to have the power that they do, the financial clout that they do, to lobby so strongly for foreign policy to take interests which are actually against the national interest of the government. I mean, I just find that absolutely incredible. Another side of all of this, which I'm involved in here in Bristol and in Britain generally, it goes back to what I was saying about our campaign, which is called The Land Is Ours, is about squatting. I mean, I was talking earlier on about, sharing out land. Now, squatting, I think, in the US is a criminal offence. One of the things that the new government here in Britain is trying to do, and there's something called the Squash Campaign, which is fighting against it here in Britain, is to try and make squatting a criminal offence here. Now, this is fascinating because we've got a situation where loads of buildings are being left empty as businesses collapse, people are having their homes repossessed, and so you've got potentially a massive boom industry in squatting, where people can take over those buildings, look after those buildings, and actually keep them up, put together, maintain them, and also have a roof over their heads. And this is one of the big problems for the financial elite around the world. So I think actually one of the most radical things is possible to do, and in a way this is echoed with these Occupy Wall Street protests, with people actually camping out in the street and possibly, potentially anyway, taking over buildings nearby these protests. We had something in France a few years ago in Paris called the Ministry of Housing Crisis, which was a massive squat in the city centre in Paris, which the squatters turned into what they characterised as an official government ministry of squatting. Because everybody should have, as it says in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, signed after World War II, a right to shelter. And this is one of the most important basic fundamental rights that this financial crisis is ripping off from us. It's been really, really actually quite horrendous in the United States, and there's a BBC program called Requiem for Detroit, which really graphically shows the way that so many houses have just been simply mothballed and are sitting there empty, whilst homeless people are roaming the streets. It just seems so utterly unjust, so fundamentally unjust as to be laughable almost. And that's what they're trying to do here in Britain. So I think actually just the whole squatting movement, the idea of taking over these empty buildings, living in them, restoring them, the DIY culture that goes with that, and looking after and showing that the squatters can actually be far better custodians of buildings than the people who on paper actually own them, which are often banks and corporations. I think this is actually one of the big things that we're going to be seeing in the Western world in the years to come, and one of the big movements. Of course, it did happen actually at the end of the Second World War. Many people came back from that war with nowhere to live. Many soldiers were demobbed, and they started squatting in the 1940s. So I think we're going to see that kind of thing as a big part of this movement. And I'm very surprised in the United States that there hasn't been more activism. In fact, it has been happening, we just haven't really been seeing it, where groups of people who've been made homeless by the financial crisis have actually, rather than just sort of live in tents in the woods or else in official government shelters, have actually moved into buildings and taken them over. And I think this is going to be a massive thing in the future. I think we're going to see loads and loads of it, and it's a very positive thing, a fantastic
Squatting in Britain was actually part of kind of like local tradition, you know, like everybody was doing it. And I just came up with an idea here that, you know, how we got the food crisis and everything. What I reckon we really need is a conspiracy cafe, you know, where like all the food is named after conspiracies, you know, like a Twin Tower burger or a Bilderberger with bacon and barbecue sauce, or World Trade Center pancakes that are savory with hot sauce. You mean, the possibilities are endless.
It's a fantastic concept, and I like the idea of entrepreneurial people who are seeing the fact that buildings are empty, moving into those buildings and utilising those buildings and running rent-free businesses from those buildings, because often it's the rent that kills the business. Very, very often you'll find that even the staff costs are quite small compared to the rent cost being, you know, whereas an organisation, a business or a charity can be quite viable if it doesn't have to pay any rent. So squatting seems to me to be the obvious and most important answer to the financial crisis. Well, obviously the banks that own the mortgages or bits of paper that say that they own those houses, they're not going to be that happy. But I'm afraid that they're... they are trumped by the fact that possession is 9/10 of the law. So if people can get into these buildings, take them over, restore them, look after them, and turn them into a place to either live or run a business from, I think that's going to be a big part of what we're going to see in the future in the West. And the reaction, the ordinary people's positive reaction to the financial situation the way it is to innovate. And that's the modern entrepreneur.
Yeah, well, hey, one thing I really wanted to talk about as well is the huge amounts of, basically empty suburbs, brand new subdivisions in LA. And this is, what's his name, George Heminger from Survive and Thrive TV. He's been going into these places, and they've still got the plastic wrapping on their benches and stuff like that, and everything's just growing up. It's like there's entire communities that are just dead, empty, nothing there. And when people go in there, they get the cops called on them. This is insane.
Yeah, well, it's you know, often the police don't actually really enjoy doing that kind of thing. Some police do. Obviously, there's a lot of the far right types who are recruited into the police for the very purpose of these kinds of hideous acts and injustices. But we're living in a country where. The police is being cut back, but we're also living in a situation where large numbers of people are starting to band together who've been affected by this financial crisis. And, of course, that's going to be a boom industry in the future. So I see people relearning some of the lessons from the past, remembering the fact that the land's been stolen from them, not just by a rich feudal elite and financial elite, but also by a whole sort of zombie banking sector that doesn't really exist. I mean, this is one of the other things in the United States, is that when, on several occasions now, and there's a whole parts of the US where this applies, is that the mortgage companies don't actually have the documents for the building. And so if the squatter or the original occupier challenges these decisions in the courts and says, right, okay, we want to see all the documentation that shows us that you own this building, we're not just moving out without it, that actually there is no proof that the mortgage company owns the building, especially through all these kind of credit default swaps and goodness knows what, these weird financial instruments. What often happens is the mortgage itself gets lost in this whole process of the mortgage being swapped and remade into a derivative or whatever, that the mortgage paperwork gets lost. And so although the mortgage company may come to you and say, right, you've got to move out, when it actually comes to court, they can't prove that they own the place. And anyway, you know, we have a situation here in Bristol, for example. We've got a free shop on Stokes Croft, which is one of the main streets in the city. And that was evicted a couple of months ago by a vindictive landlord who decided he didn't want to deal with the squatting community and actually make a deal where they could stay for a while and look after the place and restore it, which they have done. And the building was evicted, was boarded up, the entire ground floor with the steel panelling. People were evicted about 7 a.m. in the morning, and by midday the entire building had been panelled and boarded up, so no one could go in. But by 1 o'clock, the squatters were back in on the first floor, and they're now sitting in a fortress. So, I mean, this is the kind of spirit, this is the kind of attitude, I think, which is going to really break the back of this financial crisis really affecting people too much as we start to realise that those empty buildings out there are our buildings. And if you don't use it, you're going to lose it. These are the new just rules of the post-Occupy Wall Street, post-financial crisis world.
Yeah, and I think that's a pretty decent place to leave it. Thank you very much, Tony, for coming on. His websites, ladies and gentlemen, are bilderberg.org and thisweek.org.uk. Thank you very much for coming on with me. And
thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. And by the way, just for the New Zealand listeners who are listening in live, one of our local councillors has complained that the protesters who are occupying our Tier Square might be damaging the grass and distracting people from the rugby. How unfortunate.
They're getting desperate, Vinny.
How dastardly are those naughty protesters. Oh my goodness, I can't even deal with it. All right, well, we'll see you again tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen.